So if I may have your attention, thank you so much for coming to today's talk. It is our first lecture as part of the Prudhoe Centre lecture series. So I'm particularly pleased to begin with an old friend, Matt Waters. I just wanted to say a few words about Matt's work. He is one of those rare scholars that almost doesn't exist anymore, especially some of the ancient Near East and the Achaemenid Empire, well-versed in the languages of the ancient Near East, knowing well Elamite, Akkadian, and Old Persian, hence having a notion of diachrony and command over the history of the ancient Near East and the Old Persian, the Achaemenid Empire that very few possess. He is one of the only people I know who works on Neo-Elamite history, maybe the only one I know. The rest are dead.
There's reasons for that.
So we're happy to have him. His work on Elamite history was at least initially fueled by his interest in the Achaemenid Empire and the religions of the Achaemenid Empire, and that is how he came across, obviously, of the Elamite civilization, which is impossible to ignore if you work on those issues. He has he's a graduate of the University of Pennsylvania, but he has also taught before teaching as a professor at the University of Wisconsin, Eau Claire, where he's also the chair of the Department of Languages, if I'm not wrong. He has published massively. His articles are all paragons of scholarship, extraordinarily well detailed, always insightful. But he has also published recently a number of books. His most important volume that we deemed to be almost a classical is his Neo-Elamite History, produced from some two decades ago.
Almost.
And then just most recently, a wonderful history of the Achaemenid Empire that has become spontaneously the major work of reference for all teaching Achaemenid Empire courses. So my course on the Achaemenid Empire is the great beneficiary of his production. And this year he produced in what we call the Renaissance of Ctesias, an important volume on Ctesias' history, but it is different than the other volumes produced by L'Enfant and Strunk. And the difference is that he is looking at Ctesias from the Persian perspective. That means from the knowledge of the Persian myths and the Persian epic and what constitutes the Persian element in Ctesias. In that sense, it is a very unique contribution and shall not be surpassed in foreseeable time. So without further ado, I shall introduce, please join me in welcoming my dear friend Matt Waters to the podium. Thank you so much.
Can everyone hear me okay with the mic on? Thank you very much for that introduction, Raheem. I thought I was just heating up a little bit, but now I may be blushing as well. And I'd like to thank him as well for the introduction. And it's an honor to be here at the Prudhoe Wirt Center for Iranian Studies and to give a lecture. So I appreciate your attention in advance. And I would like to start briefly with an apology. We had a few logistical problems with the presentation, and I'll blame Macintosh for that rather than take it upon myself. But nevertheless, let's get the show on the road. What I'm going to be talking about today is the first few generations, or focused on the first few generations of the Achaemenid Empire. Its greatest territorial extent, the largest empire the world had known to that date, stretching from the Indus Valley to southeastern Europe and from Central Asia to northeastern Africa, as relayed by the provincial names up on the map and in Darius' own words on the bottom. I'm going to be talking about, of course, linked, but several discrete points with regard to the greater glory, if you will, the glorification of the king in relationship with the divine. I'm going to start with, for a little bit of background, the official line that is as propagated by the royal propaganda, and it's in conjunction with that is external reception, looking at a few archetypes to ground us in the material. And then I'm going to be looking at a more specific aspect of it, this line between king and god, described by some in recent scholarship as elastic or pliable, and explore how this worked, or how we think it worked, or how we're in the process of thinking it worked. during the early Achaemenid period, and look at an even more specific example of shared power and shared essence. And in my notes, I have a question mark after shared essence, but I took that off for the slide. This is manifest in some of the antecedents, specifically Akkadian Malamu and Elamite Kitin. And wrapping this with questions of ambiguity, often it seems intentional ambiguity as applied in both text and image. So of particular interest in recent ancient Near Eastern and Achaemenid scholarship has been this renewed focus in royalty's relationship with divinity, which reconsiders if there are instances where the royal may be indistinguishable from the divine, or to put it even more baldly, as some ask, was the king a god? At the risk of ruining the suspense, I'm going to tell you that no, he was not. And I would use this opportunity to say thank you very much and walk out the room, but I know that would be very cliched of me. And that simplistic answer is not a sufficiently nuanced answer. And as a superficial answer, it leaves unresolved several ambiguous pieces of data that clearly link conceptually and in some cases, essentially, and by that I mean in the literal sense of essence, the king with the god, meaning beyond the traditionally held and of course still valid view of the primacy of divine selection and the king as the god's representative on earth. How this was meant to be understood by contemporaries and how we should interpret it as modern historiographers remains, of course, at issue. For Darius I in the Achaemenids, I will also explore some ideological continuities from earlier periods in conjunction with some characteristically discrete Achaemenid elements. Let's start with glorification. I don't know how much more mileage I can get out of that slide on the top from 300, one of the more, of course, egregiously over-the-top portrayals of Orientalism in modern times, but I'd rather focus attention on the bottom that shows the king in one of many instances, this is a court-style seal, as it's called, from the early 5th century, as the master of animals in, as Mark Barrison uses the term, numinous quality, somewhere in the unreality, if you will, between human and divine. So the basic superficial messages are, of course, straightforward in such contexts. The king is set apart, glorified in a number of different ways. In image, he is the largest, the central, or in some other way, the curtain's closing already on me, okay. Do you need, is that not very legible? Is that? What's that? I'm sorry, didn't say anything. All right, we're good to go, all right. In image, he is the largest, the central, or in some other way, a, if not the, focal figure in any scene, under the aegis of, or in direct communion with, the gods. In text, and for those of you not familiar with the Achaemenid nomenclature, this is from Darius Thesetun, inscription E from Susa, again, these are all Darius, and inscriptions A and B from Naqsh-e-Rustam, his tomb inscriptions. The first two deal with the recreation, reestablishment of order from chaos. The third focusing on lineage, and the final one, divine favor or selection. And I choose these examples to illustrate a typical formula used in Achaemenid royal inscriptions found in many places throughout the empire. At no point in this official line, and again, these are illustrative of such, disseminated by Achaemenid texts, is royal legitimacy explicitly prefaced on the king's divinity. Divine favor is key, of course. Ahura Mazda is mentioned no less than 70 times in the Thesetun inscription, or so I'm told. I haven't counted that myself. Divine favor conjoined with royal lineage, and at least as explicit in a few inscriptions, military success, represent traditional markers of the right to rule. So for those seeking a god king, he is not to be found here. If we take a look outside the core at some of the external reception, our most well-known example, or culprit perhaps I should say, would be Herodotus from the Greek tradition. The gap between king and god is frequently blurred in Greek historiography. Of course, this does not mean that the Greeks viewed or considered the Persian Achaemenid king as a god, but rather they often portrayed him as believing or behaving as such. So this conjunction, of course, is of an entirely different sort than what we're looking for in the Achaemenid core. And in a word, it is based on hubris, exceptional hubris. Greek portrayals obviously have a much different agenda than ideological expression, entirely different tinge on the same source material, if you will. The interesting question to what extent Herodotus is playing, directly or indirectly,
off of his audience's knowledge of Achaemenid official ideology, I'll leave aside for the present. When the Persian kings are portrayed as more than human, it is not in a good way, arrogating powers and prerogatives that belong to the gods. So these are some examples of what I call negative glorification, portrayals that emphasize a concatenation of hubristic transgressions over the natural world, Cyrus splitting the Diyala, Cyrus diverting the Euphrates, subjecting the Araxes River. I particularly like that one. The Greek verb is zygnunai, to yoke. Darius bridging the Bosporus, and Xerxes doing likewise to the Hellespont and punishing it besides. These are barely the tip of the iceberg, examples chosen here since they all deal with a specific topos, Herodotean motifs of transgression involving bodies of water, a well-studied phenomenon. And scholars who have studied this phenomenon nicely phrase the Greek perspective to this effect. Asian rulers are guilty of wishing to assume divine powers of redistributing space and reconfiguring the order of the inhabited world. Indeed, might have proclaimed Darius the king, but not in a hubristic manner, but rather as an agent of, perhaps even a manifestation of, Ahura Mazda, the creator god. Darius commemorated his pontoon bridge with inscriptions, Herodotus tells us. From a Persian perspective, these were not testimony to hubris, but practical monuments, to the king's ingenuity, his command of vast resources, and his might. Now these, and again, barely the tip of the iceberg, are interesting enough in their own right, but as the cliché runs, they tell us much more about Greek attitudes than they do anything about ancient Persian realities. So let's switch over to take a look at the line between king and god in some of the earlier traditions. In Mesopotamian traditions, this line had been accepted as a given for a long time, with the exception of a handful of examples in the late 3rd and early 2nd millennia. The most notable among these exceptions being Naram-Sin of Akkad, whose stele you see on the slide, whose divinity was expressed both in image, here as he ascends the mountain to join the other gods, stylized by stars, and the main marker is the small horns on his helmet, marker of divinity, and also in text, both with regard to the orthography of the name, in which the dinger sign, the determinative for the divine, precedes his name, and also in an inscription that testifies to the establishment of literal cult and offerings, a temple dedicated to Naram-Sin. I will spare you the reading of the literal text since it's relatively short, but the last couple lines focus on that particular aspect of it. So through a combination of divine accoutrements, divine determinative, and literal temple and cult, Naram-Sin erased that line, but has generally been understood to be redrawn by the early second millennium. Thereafter, explicit claims of divinity of the Naram-Sin sort are sporadic at best. The evidence for divinity is scattered and inconsistently manifest from the following Ur III dynasty kings into the old Babylonian period, and even in contemporary Shamashkian Elam during the 20th century BC. On the whole, a short shelf life, as it has been described, until we see another, I suppose related, variety of it with the Assyrians several centuries later. Though its extent remains controversial, and in which, not coincidentally or surprisingly, ambiguity plays a larger role. So we fast forward to the 9th century and the famous stele of Ashurnasirpal II from Nimrud. On the left, that is an actual photo of it, and on the right, a drawing from the excavations, which shows notably in front of that stele was found an altar for votive offerings. Now, again, many other examples, but this slide in particular represents this in-between stage, if you will, between the king and the god, with the king acting as an intermediary, but also in conjunction with offerings being made to him, or at least to his image, more on that in a minute, part of, or at least partaking of, the divine sphere. And in the scholarship of the last decade or so, this in-between status, again, has been brought more to the forefront with regard to where is the king, if I can put it that way, on this spectrum between royal and divine. Is it so simple a question as one or the other? And there are a variety of different attitudes, no surprise, in modern scholarship as to how to interpret this. And since these two quotes are a little bit longer, I'll read through them quickly. Again, representative. The first one focusing on the king, I emphasize, and the second one on kingship. and a distinction that will be important from the get-go, but more later on in the talk. From Stephen Holloway's Ashur is King in 2002, the Neo-Assyrian royal titularies, narrative inscriptions, astrological prognostications, and unctuously flattering correspondence hammer away at the theme of the unique proximity of the king to the divine realm and extol his godlike powers. The kings were not members of the state pantheon, but they dwelt in closer physical and ontological proximity, I love that phrase, to the gods than any other mortals. And that ideological fact had implications for their role in the temple beyond that of beloved priest of Ishtar. And the second quote is from Irene Winter in a volume edited by Nicole Brish, Religion and Power, from 2008, again emphasizing kingship. In sum, Mesopotamian kingship was consistently treated as if infused by the divine. And these are her quotation marks, incidentally, I didn't add those. Sacral kingship being the constant in which all rulers participated. As such, kingship itself, was always divine. At the same time, the literal ascription of divinity to the ruler was reserved for times and contexts when that sacral nature needed to be strategically foregrounded. It then becomes the job of the analyst to assess the determining conditions of that necessity in specific cases, such that the boundaries between sacral and divine kingship may be clarified. Sticking with our friend Ashurnasirpal II, again, considering these as antecedents, or possible antecedents at least, for the Achaemenid material we'll get to shortly, this famous sculpture with the king in dual images, if you will, around the sacred tree, which usually has received, or has most often or frequently received attention in modern scholarship. The figure of the king mirrored and as complemented by terminology in the text has been brought to the forefront in these discussions recently. And when I say mirrored, and this is a term I'm going to be coming back to in the talk, you'll note that it's not perhaps literally so. You can see at least the gestures of the two figures are different, but it's considered to be the same king, or the king himself, I should say. Showing the Assyrian king in the Akkadian word is Tsalmu, an image that is sometimes described as participating in the essence of the divine. It also occurs as a synonym for Mashulu, which we do translate as mirror, as well as another Akkadian word that shows up in these contexts, this one included, is Tamshilu, the king as the semblance of the god, a word that carries connotations of shared physical and possibly other properties. Now, debate persists on whether to understand these equivalencies between king and god as literal statements or hyperbolic metaphor, as were the quotes I just showed you. Another example I might add is Mario Liverani, who's spent more time studying the Assyrians than perhaps anyone living. His recent book on the imperial mission just rejects outright that the king could have ever been considered a deity. Again, there are different perspectives on this. This phenomenon of mirroring of the king's image is an important piece. It's considered not simply as relaying the king communicating with the divine, but as active in and belonging to their sphere, this numinous quality, if you will, at least for certain functions of the office. So the ambiguity of the king's status, if not his essence, in these representations and descriptors seems to have been deliberate. But the question again remains, are we dealing with a metaphor or something more? In some texts, a literal equivalency may be found. Peter Machina's seminal work on the associations of royal and divine via letters, annals, and celebratory hymns offers a number of specific examples of the king having been created of divine material as the offspring of the goddess Ishtar, as elevated to the rank just below the warrior god Ninurta, and as the image, the Tsalmu, of Enlil and or Marduk. These text descriptions are unambiguous with regard to their literal translation, though their interpretation, especially when compared to other standard fare, for example, innumerable references to the king as a chief priest, the Shangu, becomes problematic. So how are we, or for that matter, how did the ancient audiences process these seemingly contradictory representations? In other words, how do they deal with ambiguous or even conflicting messages? Being the god's main representative, for example, the chief priest, and primary conduit of divine will is not necessarily the same thing as being of the god's literal family, engendered by and of the same substance as the gods themselves, unless, of course, it was meant to be understood that way. perhaps not an either-or proposition. This aspect of quasi-divine messaging, by which I mean the mirroring of the king's image, carried over into the Achaemenid period as well. Here's a drawing of a cylinder ceiling from the Persepolis Fortification Archive, a royal seal by one of the tenants, if you will, of the archive, Zishawish. And looking at that at first glance, those two figures are not the same. People consider them such, but here the mirror has changed, if you will, to an axial view, according to some interpretations. It's not, or perhaps let me rephrase it, it's not interpreted unanimously as, for example, the king and the crown prince, as you would see from the treasury relief, but rather, in Mark Garrison's perspective on this, an axial view, rotated 180, where the same figure is facing himself, if you will, across the altar, underneath or in the aegis of the winged disc. For the Achaemenids, we lack the richness of the Assyrian textual record, but we may apply some similar considerations, especially with Darius I. In her work on the seals of the Persepolis Fortification Archive, Margaret Root, in an article published in 2013, posed, quote, a concerted divine nature for the Achaemenid king, unquote, based on an assessment of the glyptic evidence that is increasingly revealing a mirroring of the images of the royal person. A key component is the ambiguity, sometimes interpreted as deliberate ambiguity, in this visual evidence, such as that discussed here. But this is, as you may guess, hardly uncontroversial. A fundamental part of these comparisons and associated questions is, of course, methodological, or even more to the point, definitional. How do we define a god, or for that matter, demarcate different dimensions or levels or hierarchy of divinity? In several of these recent treatments, scholars have referred to different levels or degrees of divinization, as appropriate as it seems, as it is confusing. For example, divinity, in some contexts at least, is more usefully assessed as a relative rather than an absolute status. Again, this goes back in some ways to the older, I don't mean this in a negative way, but simplistic distinction in texts between greater gods and lesser gods, for example. If the line between king and god became more blurred in reaction to times of volatility, confusion, and chaos, the crisis of 522 and the aftermath of Darius's victory therein is a good candidate as any for such a time. It is not a coincidence that Darius I's reign is so fundamental to Achaemenid ideological development, as it was also a time of experimentation. So let us focus on a particular component of the shared king-god relationship, the king's access to a divine power. And again, we'll start with some Assyrian antecedents. It's more easily tracked. A colored tile from Ashur showing the god Ashur, from the city Ashur, showing the god of the same name in this fiery nimbus. And also on the lower right, a cylinder sealing presentation scene from the late 8th century showing on the far right the goddess, we assume Ishtar, with a nimbus, an aura, radiating outward. This in Akkadian, the term is Malamu. A key attribute linking the king with the divine is this radiant power associated with physical might, and it is exclusive to, and in texts at least, shared by gods and kings. For gods, there is no shortage of evidence in both text and image. An image, we can find this also representative in Achaemenid texts. There's another ceiling at the top from the Persepolis Fortification Archive from Artistuna, or Artistone, as she's known from the Greek tradition, and this famous one now in St. Petersburg, showing Anahita, or syncretized Ishtar, if you will, on the back of a lion, again, with the nimbus radiating from her, being approached by a king, and probably Artaxerxes II is who this is usually identified with. I have not yet found the king portrayed in image, at least with an explicit aura, but text, as we shall see for the Neo-Assyrians at least, is another matter. This Malamu is a numinosity that may inspire adoration, awe, and or terror, and in some instances it may be used as a devastating weapon. The Akkadian terminology for radiance is quite varied. Other words include Namaratu and Palutu, and what on the surface seem to be synonyms may be part of a more complex system, a series of vocabulary coding the special relationship between the god and king, But this is a phenomenon in need of further study. About 5 years ago, Sean Oster published his study on the Malamu, which has proven very useful, but his main focus was comparison with some Northwest Semitic traditions. It is clear that the typical translation of fearsome radiance, as apt as that may be, for Malamu does not do full justice to the term. What can be said is that the Malamu often is associated with radiance, especially in the Neo-Assyrian period and thereafter. But more importantly, it is always associated with power, frequently in martial contexts, whether that be exceptional physical capabilities, sheer might, or the projection of an aura that overcomes, if not destroys, enemies. Awe-inspiring, in other words. Also, you can find commonly in texts, in the mythology for that matter, for example, in the Epic of Gilgamesh, when Gilgamesh and Enkidu confront Humbaba in the cedar forest before they are able to overcome him, they must overcome his auras. It's the same term, Malamu. When Gilgamesh, 2,000 years before the Achaemenid's Floruit, shows his face on the wall to his enemies in the short story of Gilgamesh and Aga, the opposing army immediately falls because they overcome by his radiance, his aura, his power, his Malamu. We have some examples I'll talk about here, or at least allude to, from the Assyrians as well. An early application of the Malamu by a king, actually two, excuse me, may be found during the reigns of Tukulti-Ninurta I and Tiglath-Pileser I in the Middle Assyrian period. In this instance, a radiance not only inspires terror, but is capable of destructive power such as that wielded by the gods, overwhelming and literally burning enemies. Neo-Assyrian kings in the first millennium were huge fans of this. The last quote up there is found passing throughout royal inscriptions. They were often actively clothed by the gods with it, meaning with the Malamu, and references persist sporadically throughout the Neo-Babylonian period and through the reign of Nabonidus, sporadic ones. As we shall see when we consider an Elamite parallel as well, it is not surprising that this force or this idea persisted into the Achaemenid period as well, which you have to look for. And that's not where it is, necessarily. This, another excerpt from one of Darius's tomb inscriptions from Naqsh-e-Rustam, is the prototypical statement of the king's capabilities and talents, if you will. And I should note, I have this right in front of me, it's probably easier to leave this. I left one of the old Persian words at the end of the fourth line, glossed, yomainish, because it has, there's a variety of translations applied in the modern literature, so if you don't mind a short philological aside here. Something to the effect of one of my favorites, and I mean this in a complimentary sense, is that I am fervent in counterattack with both hands and feet. Well, that works, I suppose. These are trilinguals, and though the Elamite is broken here, the Akkadian is extant, and the adjective is gatsru, which means something, well, it has a range of meanings, but something to the effect of simply just strong or powerful. But we'll leave that aside for another context. Pictures on there, I should say, too, were just illustrative to show what the text was talking about. In other textual sources, both internal and external, that refer to Achaemenid kings specifically, the aura manifests itself in a variety of ways, via the king's abilities, attractiveness, heroic exploits, the divine favor that goes with him, and or the awe-inspiring radiance that he himself generates. It's not nearly as obvious, perhaps, as in the Assyrian inscriptions. But we can see the reflection, or interpret such anyway, when Cyrus is before his Babylonian subjects, and when the Greeks describe them in their physical splendor. These are echoes, at least, of the same phenomenon. So how did the Achaemenids get there, or how do these ideas persist? Again, they're not necessarily profound or new, but you can track, if you will, antecedents for them. Another piece of evidence that until recently has been often overlooked must be considered in this context. Another aura, if you will, this one an Elamite version thereof, the word kitin, a still not clearly defined, at least not by us, concept that may be traced throughout Elamite history, but only sporadically and mainly via personal names in the early periods. in its initial sense, attested in Elam during the Sukkot-Ma period, in the early second millennium, Kitin referred to divine protection. And it is in this sense that the word was taken into Akkadian as Kidinu. And that term took on a life of its own in that tradition as generally applied to the protective status of entire cities, a legal concept. And this is a closely related and well-studied phenomenon that shows the interchange between some of these concepts, as vocabulary for that matter, but one that may take me too far off course for my purposes here. The Elamite word Kitin is most frequently attested during the Neo-Elamite period and within Neo-Elamite royal proclamations. It shows up multiple times in royal inscriptions from the late 8th century in the reign of Shutruk-Nahhunta II to the mid-6th in the so-called bronze plaque from Persepolis, not including one Achaemenid attestation in one of Xerxes' inscriptions, but I'll get to that in just a minute. The vast majority of the extant attestations occur in inscriptions of a certain Hani, and that is with the slide up here, the Kutur of Ayapur, which is believed to be in or include the region of the sanctuaries near Iza in eastern Khuzestan, Kulifara and Shekafel Salman. And I just took a few excerpts from a much wider spread, if you will, of the sanctuary that show some of the sculptures, and I don't know how well they're showing up here, but they show, many of them show processions, and art historians have pointed to the site frequently as an antecedent or predecessor for the portrayals on the Apadana. And is that picture in the lower right, which I'm guessing may not show up, if you have a close-up at all, that is going to be the inscription in question. So of these roughly 20 attestations of the word in Neo-Elamite context, 17 come from Hani's inscriptions, and most of those from just one set, those as labeled in F. Koenig's dated but still seminal publication of Elamite royal inscriptions as EKI number 75. This text poses numerous problems, as most Neo-Elamite inscriptions do. If they're not broken or sporadic, they contain one hapax legomenon after another, and there's a reason that Neo-Elamite is understudied, I suppose. The body of the narrative appears to be a straightforward proclamation of a victorious campaign, the collection of plunder, and its dedication to the gods. This standard fare is bookended on both sides by lengthy invocations of Kitin at the beginning and end. The Kitin is associated with gods and is accompanied by some untranslatable appellatives, for example, Temben, which appears to have something to do either with establishment or transfer, depending on which dictionary you consult. It clearly but not exclusively carries a connotation of protection when invoked of the gods, whose essences seem closely bound with this same Kitin that is expressly stated to encompass the heavens and the earth, a cosmic and divine concept. Hani associates the Kitin with a number of specific deities, including the chief deity responsible for protection, again, of Elamite kings, and Sishumban. In this inscription, Hani invokes the gods, the guarantors of Kitin, to protect his dedications, sculptures, and inscriptions that he added to an already centuries-old sanctuary. The switching of subjects, either the gods or Hani, regarding the application of Kitin leads to an important observation, that Hani himself is able to invoke and to apply Kitin's power directly, or the power of Kitin might be better put. Thus it appears that Kitin is both a protective aura and an applicable force, at the risk of some oversimplification, a phenomenon on parallel with the Akkadian Malama. Parallel cannot be stretched too far yet, at least, a work in progress, but I suspect mutual influence, if not direct connection, in the phenomenon itself and in its ramifications for the shared relationship, if not essence, of god and king. In Akkadian texts, the Malamu is also conceptualized as a covering, either real or symbolic, in real meaning in certain rituals, and in this sense it approximates Kitin and vice versa. And with this backdrop in mind, let us move on to the one curious but critical carryover of Kitin into the Achaemenid period, its use by Xerxes. I should note, too, the daiva, it's translated in various words, the demons, if you will, English S, English plural, that's why that S is not italicized, just for ease of use. This one attestation of Kitin in Achaemenid royal inscriptions occurs in Xerxes' famous Daiva inscription, XPH, excerpted on the slide, specifically in line 31. It is anomalous and telling. In the trilingual inscription, there is no equivalent in the old Persian or Akkadian versions, which include only a short statement to the effect that Xerxes commanded that the Daivas no longer be worshipped. Now, the power of royal command contains its own efficacy, of course, but it is curious that in the Elamite version, with explicit reference to Khitan, there is more to it. By implication, an active royal application of a divine power, or essence. Ahura Mazda is mentioned in the standard formula, Zal Min Ahura Mazda, by the will or favor or effort of, but it is the king who has applied Khitan upon the offending spot, so that the Daivas, in English plural, not be worshipped again. Are we to take it that Khitan was simply a guarantor against future Daiva worship, meaning a protective aura summoned as an interdiction, or was the Khitan also involved in the effected destruction itself, or both? If so, it is much more elusive, and for that matter elusive, than the destructive power of the Assyrian Malama. The frequent Neo-Assyrian military applications of such provide an analog. Speaking of ambiguity, move on to the next stage, and back to our images. We're looking at here, obviously, in the top of a close-up of the BC-2 inscription relief, and revisiting the court-style seal from Persepolis on the lower right that you saw earlier. So in order to contextualize some recent suggestions of Achaemenid deification of kings, the first and foremost component linking the king with the god must be revisited. This is the winged disc, a symbol, of course, far older in itself than the Achaemenid period, and most famously displayed here at BC-2. The winged disc in Achaemenid glyptic appears both with and without the figure, or the figure at different scaling, you can compare the slide on the lower right, in various contexts. Who or what was it meant to represent? Ahura Mazda, Fravashi, the spirit of the king, or the Avestan Farna, the king's glory, rather than a deity per se? Some Avestan attestations emphasize power and radiance, or even fire, but at least conceptually, which may at least conceptually be considered a descendant of the Malamu. And perhaps it has been posed by Mark Garrison that the winged disc is meant to encompass all of these things, even Elamite Khitan, a multivalent symbol meant to encompass these discrete but related concepts, but that, again, is another paper. We're going to take a look at the crowns of the two figures, Darius and the winged disc, or Ahura Mazda, as I at least, and many others, identify in this particular portrayal. At BC-2, the connection, or perhaps even identification of Darius with Ahura Mazda is exemplified by Mark Garrison's recent observation, which I paraphrase. It cannot have escaped the planners, nor one assumes troubled them, that many viewers of the reliefs at Behistun and Nakshi Wusta might have made the logical visual inference that Darius and the figure in the winged disc were one and the same. In addition to the physical resemblance, the reciprocating gestures also link the two main figures. And here's a further close-up of the crowns and a drawing of the eight-pointed star on the upper right. That is, or serves as another link. The crowns are clearly of different type, but they have this important common element in the eight-pointed star. Ahura Mazda's tall headdress is wrapped by bullhorns topped by an encircled eight-pointed star, specifically inserted or modified, you can tell by the cutting around it, after the fact by a plug, which is a notable feature in its own right. The symbols on Darius's crown in the upper left have been re-examined by Margaret Root based on close examination of George Cameron's squeezes of the relief, and discern not as rosettes, as has often been assumed, but as a chain of encircled eight-pointed stars. That symbol in Mesopotamian tradition is a long-standing marker of divinity in general, since the earliest sculptures and, of course, some of the earliest cuneiform signs. It is often specifically associated with Ishtar, sometimes with Shamash, and can even be used as a generalizing symbol for other deities. Darius liked that symbol. We can see this also from a freestanding stele, now only extant in fragments, obviously, from Babylon that was placed along the Sacred Way, which contained a condensed version of the BC-2 relief and inscription. The one extant symbol in the field facing the king, and that is this piece right here, is the eight-pointed star, the same star on Ahura Mazda's and Darius's crowns at BC-2. So what was Darius going for here? Was it meant to foster a subtle intonation of or an identification with deity? And note the question mark as I pose that. And this question of ambiguity and its
presumed intentional application is what underlay recent interpretations or reconsiderations of these symbols. And you can find this not only in image, but also in text. And just to go present a brief example from the Cyrus cylinder from Babylon. In line 31, and I'll do the brief version here in light of the time, the context is Cyrus's restoration of sanctuaries after his conquest, sanctuaries at various parts throughout Mesopotamia. And the or, distinguishing those two translations, you'll find both in modern publications as such, comes down to how one interprets, use that word, I guess we can say translates, the verb nadu at the end of the Akkadian, on which the preceding adverbial phrase applies. It can have both connotations. So either of those translations, if you will, is correct as a literal translation. The question is as to what sense is meant to be understood in that particular context. Both of them have, supply standard commentary in the Babylonian tradition. The first, that these sanctuaries were age-old, they were erected long ago, of great antiquity, and the other is that the inept and unworthy Nabonidus had neglected them for a long time, so thus they had been abandoned or in ruins. That verb nadu shows up in another form, only one other time earlier in the inscription in line 10, in which it clearly, or more clearly at least, has the sense of abandonment, but it's a different context than you find in lines 30 following. So why not consider both applicable? Again, not as an either-or proposition. The ambiguity embedded within the word nadu allowed emphasis of two things. Again, not only were the temples ancient, but they were also neglected by the unworthy Nabonidus. Cyrus may thus be allowed to have demonstrated his respect for Babylonian norms through the correction of a previous offense, as well as his acknowledgement and maintenance of a long-standing tradition. Let's look at one more apropos for the discussion at hand today. And this is an inscription from Susa, inscription K of Darius, found by the French mission in Susa and first published in 1929. Only one exemplar extant, Old Persian only, and stamped on a mud clay brick. And that it was stamped, of course, implies that it was mass-produced or distributed in many other places on the site. The inscription is curious, at least to me, because although it has been a long-known member of the corpus, it has been rarely cited. When it has been cited, it has never been treated as anything other than a forceful expression of Darius's piety, a testimony to his Mazdaean tendencies, and that works, so perhaps one should not read further into it. But the phrasing in line 4, which is bolded on the slide, is anomalous. It has no direct analog within the rest of the corpus. The phrase in question is translated as a possessive and, as such, again, is taken as a more forceful expression of the special relationship between king and god. And here, just like writers or scribes for that matter often do, consider playing with or considering alternate translations of this particular passage, again, the ambiguity of the words. If we can hypothesize a concerted effort to link the king with the god through image, why not in text? Now, note the qualifications, if you will, in what follows here. So this is hypothetical. If we were to consider, even hypothetically, translating the genitive as a partitive, the nuance changes. It matches up better in conceptualization to Assyrian examples alluded to earlier, but at this stage you're starting to wonder, well, who cares about the Assyrians, right? We're talking about the Achaemenids. But those that enunciate a close, even essential link between the king and the god, with emphasis on sharing the divine substance, not an issue of possession per se, but rather a shared part of the whole. The phrasing, regardless, is brief and elusive. If you consider the context, the immediate context of the rest of the inscription, it seems fairly clear that one should take this, again, as generally the case, as a possessive. Both senses, frankly, seem a little bit discordant to me, but the possessive less so. And if you were detecting ambivalence or ambiguity in how I am presenting this, I will say that you have that exactly right. So what does all this mean for the Achaemenid king and slash as divine? While not an exact parallel, it seems we could take a cue from Egyptological studies and focus on the office rather than the individual. We can easily find the Persian king as divine, or at least the office of kingship as divine, in Egyptian text and image, the king as pharaoh. Here is Darius
as Pharaoh from the Temple of Hibis in near the Karga Oasis in southwestern Egypt, which is part of a larger scene showing the king making offerings to Amun-Re and Mut, complete with dedicatory inscriptions of the gateway and doors. We might assume, in light of the importance of the winged disc in royal Achaemenid iconography, indeed while looking at one manifestation of a similar symbol in the place of its likely origin, that Darius was delighted with this parallel image. The falcon horse, here termed the Bedadite, is an icon that appears commonly in royal scenes surmounting royal titles. It is hard to fathom, or at least it is hard for me to fathom, that the Achaemenids compartmentalize these various subject traditions exclusively within their own context. And since this is a little longer and I'm looking, I don't have that on my sheet, so I'll have to lean over here. I'm going to read the quote here from a seminal work on Egyptian kingship. "Is a divine institution, in a way itself a god, or at least an image of the divine, and capable of becoming its manifestation. Each incumbent, each pharaoh, is fundamentally a human being, subject to humankind's limitations. When the king took part in the roles of his office, especially in rituals and ceremony, his being became suffused with the same divinity manifest in his office and the gods themselves. Pharaoh would be recognized by those who saw him as imbued with divinity, characteristically radiant." There's that sense again as well. The evidence points otherwise, and by that I mean otherwise to the fact that the Achaemenids would have compartmentalized these things within their own traditions, although they did so at times, but in their development of an ideology of a universal empire based on the centrality of the king. So we can take more from this Egyptian connection and apply it to some of these enigmatic, quasi-divine features of Achaemenid kingship, specifically what some Egyptologists refer to as the limited divinity of the king, at least this is how it was taught to me, as per this excerpt and as discussed previously, perhaps an analog to divinization of Assyrian royal images, if not the kings themselves. That brings me, with an end in sight to the presentation, if not to the work and the project as a whole, to this sort of missing link in Achaemenid studies, a well-known figure, the guardian genius of Pisargadae. That is a picture of it, obviously, on the left, and drawing on the right of the same figure. The only one extant of four total, perhaps more, this from the eastern door jamb of the northeast doorway of Gate R. Figure is well known, frequently cited, but remains enigmatic. Who and what is the guardian figure meant to represent? And this will not surprise you, amongst modern scholars, interpretations abound. A figure of Assyrian inspiration, note the genius's wings, with Elamite robe and hairstyle and an Egyptian crown. Hybrid figure and internationalizing figure of the first order that has not been found outside this specific context of Pisargadae. If it was meant to be an amalgam of a young empire, we are missing other representations of it. Is that because we've not found other representations, or was it an experiment that did not take elsewhere, or does it apply to something unique to Cyrus's capital in Pisargadae? The dating of the figure also remains a subject of debate, and whether one assigns it to Cyrus or to Cambyses, or I suppose Bardiya's six-month reign in 522, must remain a possibility, or to Darius has major ramifications for its interpretation. It's often associated with Cyrus as an aspirational representation of a forthcoming conquest of Egypt, but I myself am dubious of that particular approach. Or interpretation, I should say. The inscription above the figure, as recorded by various 19th century travelers, this one by Sir Robert Kerr Porter, published in 1821, is a well-known inscription as well. With few exceptions now, it is attributed to Darius, and understood in context of Darius's not-so-subtle attempts to link himself to the founder Cyrus's family, or rather to co-opt Cyrus into Darius's family. It is an odd inscription in a number of ways beyond placement. Like most, I hesitate to term it as a label per se for the figure, since the same inscription in five copies extant, and presumably several more, was found elsewhere at Pisargadae, for example, the picture on the right from Palace P. Anta. One cannot help but wonder at what level its placement and Gate R may have been meant to be, suggestive if not signaling, on parallel with the physical resemblance between Darius and Ahura Mazda. Margaret Root's seminal assessment of this figure's possibility still resonates, whether it represents a syncretic deity, some metaphorical vision of an abstract idea of imperial domain, or a vision of Cyrus himself in a mythical aspect of ideal kingship, which, if you wish to relate the inscription to it, that last one seems a likely candidate. Regardless, the figure uses a similar hand gesture as Ahura Mazda to Darius at BC-Tomb and at Nakshi Rustam. It seems unlikely to be a coincidence. Rather, it may reinforce a connection. Perhaps a divinized, I put that in quotes, Cyrus after his death, or an Assyrian-style divinization of his image, also ambiguous, an image mediating a decreasing space between Darius and Ahura Mazda. There is no place for an outright proclamation of the Naram-Sin sort, but the presumed deliberate ambiguity in some representations offers several suggestive possibilities, and Darius and the Achaemenids had an arsenal of examples for inspiration. Continuity with earlier models and implements, for example, Milamu and Kitin that we discussed, demonstrates the king's access to and sharing of divine power, the partaking of a divine essence, whether it be interpreted to be via his person or a function of his office. If Darius did not outwardly proclaim his divine essence in text, it seems to me that he may have subtly encouraged it in image, or at least not discouraged it. Image may be used to portray or to suggest things that text could or should not. The link, of course, was always there, close connection between king and divine. In modern parlance on this topic, the question will ultimately return to the definitional one I posed earlier, what exactly is or makes a god? Where on the spectrum, if it can be put that way, did the Achaemenid king belong, perhaps a moving target based on functions of his office? I am convinced that the conceptual terms, at least Milamu and Kitin, though, informed the Achaemenid royal divine relationship. How far one wants to take the sharing in the divine power, what in essence appears to be a divine essence, must also, for the present, remain impressionistic. And on that some ambiguous note, I will end, and thank you.